Scotch Stories by Whiskey FM.
So it would be marvellous to talk a bit about Berry Brothers and Rudd and its relationship with whiskey. I think it's, you can't argue with the fact that Berry Brothers and Rudd is renowned throughout the world as being a wine merchant, probably the most famous wine merchant in the world. When did Berry Brothers and Rudd start to sell whiskey? And how has Berry Brothers and Rudd's relationship with whiskey changed over the years and the way that it's interacted with the whiskey?
Well, originally, Berry Brothers and Rudd, the original shop in St. James Street, was a coffee supplier to the 100 or so coffee houses that existed in the at the end of the 17th century in, you know, one of the wealthier parts of London. But just supplying coffee was not enough to a little business. They wanted to supply other things as well that the gentlemen who lived around that area require. So they quickly went into spices as well, which were very precious in those days. One doesn't realise it, but they were incredibly expensive and exotic and from the Far East, and ships could bring it back. There were no aeroplanes or anything. So it was all incredibly expensive stuff, and the only people who could really afford it were the same sort of people that could afford to buy coffee. In the 1650s, 1698, when we started the business. So we got into spices thereafter, and then probably it took about a century before Berry Brothers, or the company, got into the world of wines and spirits. And in the 1800s, the very much Berry Brothers and Rudd would be a go-to place for people in the know in the area, but we don't pretend to be anything other than just a local retail shop, really, in the world of wines and spirits. But the customers that came here were quite demanding. They needed the proper stuff, they needed the real stuff, the really, really good stuff, so it was up to us to make sure that we had all the very best stuff we possibly could get hold of in the cellars in Berry Brothers and Rudd. And a lot of that was in cask, so in barrels. And in up until the 1850s, 1860s, most of the wine and spirits that we sold was actually in bulk form. So people would select from a cask, and then they would bring in the bottles, or get somebody to bring in refillable bottles. And then they would be filled by the man who eventually we call the butler. He was called the bottler, of course, in those days, but the East End accent has transformed it into what we now know as the butler. So in those days, the Berry Brothers and Rudd was very much associated with whiskey and with gin, of course, which was prevalent in those days. If we're talking about a slightly different level of people coming here, because the people who lived in the West End of London tended to be very well off. So they were not known as probably drinking beers and cheap gins. They were better known for drinking the top end of wines and spirits. In the 1800s, there was very little matured whiskey at all. I mean, you have to pass forward to the 1860s, really, before whiskey even started to get known. But it probably would have been, you know, there have been a few distilleries and cask, the odd cask here or there, that would have been in Berry's cellars and then sold to people who were connoisseurs of Scotland's finest spirit. So I think it sort of developed from there. Then in the 1900s, I suppose, then obviously things got, Scotch whiskey became better known. And blended whiskies, thanks to Mr. Usher and Mr. Walker and Mr. Mackey and Mr. Buchanan and Mr. Dewar, that had suddenly become a sort of gentleman's drink. And blended whiskies came to the fore. And then, of course, Berry Brothers said, well, okay, why don't we have our own? In the same way that Chivas, and the same way that most of these companies had their own, what they called Italian grocers. We were an Italian grocer, I suppose, down here. And we just put together three or four casks to create consistency in a whiskey, which we then offered to people as our own. And in our case, it was called it was called Cutty Sark. In Mr. Walker's case, it was called Johnny Walker. And Shivers, it was Shivers. But it was just basically shops putting together a blend of whiskies, which they could produce a consistency. So that time and time again, the people would come back and knew what they were buying. Whereas before that, it was very difficult because it was individual casks here and there. And with spirits, Berry Brothers and Rudd just went on developing, choosing, selecting with an understanding and experience the best of the best. And still today we do rums and we do cognacs. We don't do, we do some single casks, rums, we do quite a lot of single casks now, it's becoming very popular. But not nearly as many as we do with whiskey, of course.
When the Berry Brothers and Rudd whiskey team is out and about, I suppose all around the world, what sort of preconceptions do they come up against, if any? And are these preconceptions welcomed?
Berry Brothers and Rudd is very well known, I think, within the corridor of the M25. If you go outside the M25 in the UK, Berry Brothers gets less and less well known. It's still reasonably well known as being one of the top three or four wine merchants in the UK in terms of being able to provide the top quality products at a good age and a good price. Internationally, it's not nearly so well known. We have operations, however, in Hong Kong, in Singapore, in Japan. So it's reasonably well known, again, amongst the people who like to really enjoy the top wines. But it's not a sort of, you know, in the States we own a company as well. But it's not, Berry Brothers and Rudd is better known in the UK, of course, than it is internationally. So when we introduce Berry Brothers and Rudd, quite often in New York, you will come, I guess, up with somebody, you talk to somebody who, yeah, he does actually hold stock with Berry Brothers and Rudd, because we sit on about jolly nearly a million cases of wine down in Basingstoke. So rather than just a tiny little shop here, we have six or seven warehouses down in Basingstoke where people will store their wine with us, temperature controlled, under laser beam security. And they pay us a storage fee for every year, but then we can ship that stock around the world. But you know, at the top end, then it is reasonably well known. We don't own any vineyards, so we rely on a very good relationship that we have with the top chateau around the world to provide us with enough stock for our developing consumer base. A lot of money is now coming in from China, as they get to know and understand the ethos and the way that we operate in Berry Brothers and Rudd. The United States now, we've got some people now based in the United States who are developing that side of the business as well. So when people talk about Berry Brothers and Rudd, they do recognize it as being one of the top end wine merchants in the world, but it's a very small number of people. And just as well, because we probably wouldn't be able to supply everybody with the sort of wine that is sought after now. But it's horses for courses, and we don't come up against too many barriers. Obviously, if shipping wine into certain countries, there's a certain amount of difficulty, but we can maintain it here for them, we can warehouse it here for them, and if they want to come and collect it and take it back to wherever they live, where the import duties must be quite high, and they take it in various, you know, duty free, or they take it in through their allowance and so on. That is perfectly possible. But most of our business is actually done with private individuals who are quite happy to pay the taxes and duties on their wines going into the individual countries, but they just really want to consume the very best.
Yeah. So in terms of whiskey, what does Berry Brothers and Rudd want to be renowned for amongst whiskey drinkers across the world?
Yeah, I think, you know, like any wine merchant, you want to have a reputation of putting into a bottle a quality of product which is unquestionable. And it may not be your taste, but the quality of it is going to be absolutely outstanding. So quality of the product goes into it first of all. Secondly, then, in terms of whiskey, we're looking for complexity, texture, balance, delivery. Mm-hmm. So delivery, what you get on the nose, you get on the palate, is very important. We're not looking to replicate what the distillery has out there as a commercial product. So we're dealing with individual casks. An individual cask is just a snapshot in time. Now each cask is going to be slightly different. You're not going to get a consistency between one cask and another cask. And in a way, that is a benefit. But it's not for building a brand of a distillery. You need to have consistency to be able to do that, to be able to project mm-hmm. that. So for Berry Brothers and Rudd, what we probably like to do is to produce something which is going to be slightly off the wall, slightly different to that that's being produced by the within the parameters of the distillery itself. We can innovate by combining two different distilleries. We can make blended malts, which we do reasonably well, I think, now. We've got this wonderful range called the Classic Range, at very accessible prices, at £32 a bottle for an Islay, classic Islay style, or a classic Speyside, or a classic Sherry style, or a lightly peated style. So that's a range that everybody can afford and get into. It's a springboard, really, into our own individual cask or independent bottling, single cask bottlings. We absolutely adore putting whiskies together like that for the blended side, because we very much feel that a blended whiskey is totally underrated nowadays, berated yes. by quite a lot of people who think that single malts tend to be so much better than blends. It's not
it's
necessarily true.
It's not
necessarily true. It can be very different. But not every single malt that you put into a bottle is going to be as good as the great blends. There's no doubt about it that things have changed over the years, but blends have just been magic.
Yeah.
And it's just, blends I always think are wonderful on a Friday evening when you've got a bit of a thirst, you can hear the whiskey and soda.
Yes.
and the blended whiskey just hits the spot. Whereas single malt very much is sort of after dinner drink, and well, even having before dinner as well, but you've got to think about it.
Yeah, it's much more thoughtful.
It's a connoisseur's sort of drink.
Which distillery have you enjoyed working with the most when you've been selecting casks for?
Yeah, I've spent most of my life with Glenrothes, so the fun of working with one particular distillery is that you understand the nuances, you understand how the spirit mixes with individual casks, and the type of cask that it goes best with. In a way, it's like growing a child. You put him or her through the right, hopefully the right schooling, to suit the character, and then try and steer them then into wherever their strengths lie. And the same thing happens when you're bringing up the whiskey. You're putting it in the right casks, making sure that it's developing in the right way and as fast enough as fast as you want it to develop without developing too fast and going off the rails. So on favourite distilleries, I think in terms of working with is Glenrothes, because I've done most of my life working with Glenrothes. But I've also worked with three or four other distilleries, which I've enjoyed, and each one is certainly very different in terms of culture, the people that are there. The most exciting thing, I think, apart from the quality of the spirit itself and how you make the spirit and how you mature it, which is even more important, or as important, is the culture of the distillery itself, and that comes through the people.
Mm.
It comes from the manager down. And I've always been amazed at the knowledge that these guys have who work in the distillery. They've probably been there, three or four generations of their family. You get some people with wonderful memories of the stories and anecdotes. You get some people who have got unbelievable brains about knowing where certain casks are in the distillery and where they're situated and what they taste like and that sort of thing. How they know what it tastes like, I don't know. To me, it's the whole culture of the distillery. It's not only the flavour, the cask side, but it's the people as well. And that's what I was saying, you know, my father, when he said, you know, you will never find a job that incorporates those three things of people and liquid and travel. It does. There is something holistic about the Scotch whisky industry that and most of the character and the heart really comes from the distillery itself.
It's been lovely getting to know and getting to see what Dartmouth Distillery has been up to over the last couple of years. And Berry Brothers and Rudd are the only stockist or official stockist for...
Yes, we're the agent for Dartmouth internationally, yes, and the UK.
So that must have been very exciting to have watched the Dartmouth story unfold, really.
Enormously so. I mean, it was kind of secret for many people. There were a few connoisseurs who knew that it was in existence, you know, 10, 12 years ago when it was very much a sort of farm distillery. Brilliantly put up and brilliantly run. And one of the very few distilleries in Scotland, if not possibly one of the only distilleries in Scotland, that didn't actually go outside looking for capital to develop it. And I think the brothers, Francis and Ian, are just the most lovely people. They're primarily farmers. And this is like going back 200 years in my family as well, who were doing exactly the same thing. They were farmers first and distillers second. And it's just the most lovely spirit. It's turned out absolutely beautiful. It's got a great name. But more than anything, again, it's the whole culture of Dartmouth. It's the ethos of it, it's the matter of factness of it. What you get, what you see is what you get. And there's no artificial marketing about it either. It's straight from the heart. And you know, when you have a product like that, you believe in it, you develop it with love and with passion, you promote it with love and with passion, which is what we do at Berry Brothers and Rudd. It's not a question of selling it, it's just really a question of trying to find the right homes for it.
Well, they're pieces of art. I think those bottles that Francis and Ian have created are just incredible. And they are.
You see, each individual cask is kind of, you know, it's nurtured, and we sell so little of it, we release so little of it, or they release so little of it, that it's become, it shouldn't. I think it's a shame in many ways that a lot of it is just collected.
Yeah.
There's a certain amount of it which obviously it goes up in price, and people like make money quite easily.
Yes.
But at the end of the day, the brothers make a whiskey to be drunk and enjoyed. And as you can see, it wasn't a hugely commercial operation, otherwise they would have obviously done it in a very different way. And I think we're very honoured to be selected as the distributor, because I think the ethos of Berry Brothers and Rudd is kind of similar to that, that we're not going pile it high and sell it cheap. We're going to seek out the best buyers, the people who really appreciate quality to sell to. And it sounds a bit corny, but if you can afford to do it, then it makes a lot of sense. In today's world, a company like Berry Brothers and Rudd, which is privately owned, doesn't have the same sort of shareholder pressure that a multinational would have to produce the goods time and time out. So the difference is that we can think long term and behave long term, as opposed to needing cash for today.
So there's no cheapening of the brand, which I think is utterly apparent. Brand is even the wrong word.
Well, I suppose you can say brand berries. Absolutely. And I think what it stands for, and we were alluding to a little earlier on, is to do with, you know, we'd love to have that badge of confidence from the consumer in us. But in order to have that confidence, they have to understand that what we exude is authority and expertise in the world in which we are involved. And you know, it's so much easier to trust a doctor that you have confidence in, or a tailor, or anyone in the services that you have built up a confidence in, and leave that part then entirely to them to deal with, and for them then to interpret, you know, the style of clothing that you really want, and to be able time and time to do that, or a hairdresser even. You know, you have a confidence. And especially what we're trying to do with Berry Brothers and Ride is build up that confidence and then get more and more people coming in. Because you can't cut corners on these things. At that end of the business, and the average price of a bottle of wine here is about 3 or 4 times that of the average price of a bottle of wine in the supermarket. Overall, that's in a year. So you're obviously dealing with a different type of wine and a different, in many ways, different type of clientele, which the whiskey business has in bundles. You know, in 1970, the price of a bottle of whiskey was 3 days' pay. Today, that same bottle of blended whiskey is 2 hours minimum wage, 2.5 hours minimum wage. So it's gone from 3 days, so inaccessible,
yeah,
into something which is totally accessible. And in many ways, that's helped Scotch whisky. And I think the social media, as I mentioned before, is very important, because you get a lot of people who do know quite a lot of it about Scotch whisky, feeding that appetite for knowledge. I'll be very careful on that, because there's a lot of stuff out there that's not necessarily totally 100% yeah, accurate. So reliability is very important, and that's why somewhere like Berry Brothers and Rudd will always be a go-to place, because you've got expertise there, masters of wine, you've got experts in the world of whiskey and rum and gin and so on.
It would be fair to say, in that case, that Berry Brothers and Rudd promotes connoisseurship within our industry, which is a marvellous thing. Do you find that younger drinkers are attracted to that? I mean, we have a fairly funny, I think our younger generation in the UK has a strange relationship with alcohol in lots of ways. Overconsumption, binge drink, all these sorts of things. How does Berry Brothers and Rudd encourage that younger generation and newer whiskey drinkers into a world of connoisseurship, I suppose?
Well, it's a very good question, and you obviously fish where the fish are. It's something that you try and promote through. It's a lot of it is done through personal contacts. So it's word of mouth. We have 90,000 customers, I think, 20,000 pretty active ones, and a lot of it is word of mouth. So we do encourage, obviously, new customers coming in. Well, in the UK, we're kind of at we're always obviously regenerating customers and new customers coming in, and the reputation is out there. Internationally is where we really want to try and sow the seed a little bit more. And so we're taking great steps in planting people in the United States of America, as I said, and also in the Far East, in Asia, to develop those contacts there.
Glenrothes, which we've spoken about already, but Berry Brothers and Rudd no longer owns Glenrothes, is that
no,
correct?
No, that's right. And in fact, when we took it on in 1987, we didn't own it at all. We had an understanding, which was to develop the brand on behalf of our friends, the Edrington Group, who were the owner of Macallan and, in those days, Tamdhu and Bullhaven and various others. And then in 2010, we actually purchased the brand, not the distillery. And we, because it had been pretty successful around the world, we had moved it up from selling absolutely zero up to about 500,000 bottles a year in 2010. We purchased the brand from them, and stock. So we bought, we had been buying a lot of our own stock anyway, but laying it down, which is not what had happened before, because it hadn't been laid down for single malts, it'd been laid down for blends, and so it's a different policy, completely different wood policy. So then in 2010, having purchased the brand, we then invested our own money. Obviously, it wasn't just a joint venture, it was our own money in behind the brand. And then in 2017, we had a very amicable relationship with Edrington, who wanted to buy it back. So they bought back a brand which had been nurtured and gone through his childhood and adolescence and then was ready to go out into the big wide world of Edrington. And of course they own their distributors around the world, in major countries and around the world, so which little old Berry Brothers and Rudd didn't. Mm. So they had access to a distribution system which we find a little more difficult.
Was it painful saying goodbye to Glenmorangie?
As a company, very sad, because in the same way that we said goodbye to Cutty, it just outgrew us, really. And that's what happened with Glenrothes as well. It was, in a way, it was successful. But, you know, you want a kid to be successful. And so when you can no longer teach it, when you can no longer add anything to the party, then you let them go. And yes, you have an enormous amount of pride behind knowing that you've given it or her, him, or the right education and developed it properly. And yes, of course, it's enormously sad to say goodbye, but it's still around.
Yeah.
And it's still going from strength to strength. And you know full well that the early days, the formative years, were actually developed through Berry Brothers and Rudd. So, and it just simply outgrew us. And they was too successful, I guess.
Yeah. It must be so satisfying, though, to see that brand being so successful. And
it's lovely.
Yeah, a company like Edrington taking it on.
Yeah, I mean, they have been enormously successful, of course, Edrington, in the world of whiskey, with Famous Grouse and Macallan in particular. And I see that they will probably do exactly the same with Glenrothes. It's there, ready for the making. Mm. It's got every positive imagery out there. They've changed it from the vintage-only concept into an age statement, which makes a lot of sense for stocks, because stock management was terribly difficult with vintages. Great fun to promote,
yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
And it's a collector's item as a result. The vintage Glenrothes now, as you can still buy at reasonable prices.
I saw some on the auction. I had to look.
Some of the older ones are now creeping up in price. But particularly the 1970s and the 80s are you can still find some for reasonable prices. You know, compared to the others from that sort of period. And don't forget, it came from this. Macallan's, a sister distillery, in the same camp as Glenrothes in the 1970s. So very similar wood policies were being employed at the time by the same company. And the difference is Macallan's spirit is a slightly oilier style of Glenrothes, but they're neighbouring distilleries. They're about a mile and a half apart. Different microbiology, slightly different texture. A slightly different style, but similar sort of wood policy, and so, in my view, there were great merits to Glenrothes. There still are great merits to Glenrothes, and I can see it becoming one of the more favoured single malts from Speyside in the future.
Do you think the concept of vintage in whiskey is not dead, but I suppose Glenrothes would have been one of the main advocates for it. Now they're not doing it. I suppose really you were one of the main advocates.
I suppose, yes, and then we were copied, which is always a form of flattery, I suppose. Vintages, for us, because we had a very limited amount of stock, it was quite an easy thing to manage. But it was also quite an interesting concept, because you were you could explain it in the same way that I explained earlier about the wines. You have the character of the wine and the personality of the vintage. So each vintage is going to be slightly different, but it's going to retain the character. And to me, it was a wonderful way of not just having the same old product time and time again, but you could actually give people an understanding of what happens if you put it into an American oak sherry cask, or an American oak and a bourbon cask, or an American sherry, or a Spanish oak and a sherry, an American oak combination, or any combinations. So it was basically our way of saying, look, you choose. The character of this distillery is going to be unquestionable, unimpeachable. It's one of those givens. But now, look, just see which is your preference on this. So you give us not only age difference, but also in terms of wood policy. And to me, it was enormous fun. the most interesting part of my whole career, really, in production side, has been the understanding of maturation, or beginning to understand, because nobody understands maturation, yes, actually fully, but to begin to understand,
yeah,
you know, what goes best with the whiskey. And you can do that if you own a few thousand casks. You can play around with it a little bit. It does involve quite a bit of nosing and tasting, and it's not quite such an easy job as most people think it is.
It sounds delightfully fun, but actually, when you're smelling lots and tasting lots, it must be quite difficult
It is difficult. You soon get used to it, but it's a time consuming. Of course, you can only taste a certain number before your judgment becomes a little bit coloured. So nose is the most important thing, and luckily I have one big enough to to differentiate relatively easily.
Fantastic. Thanks, Ronnie.